Good evening. It's great to see a good crowd of people here, just one or two empty seats like mine that I've just vacated. There's nothing worse, I always think, than speaking to a half-empty audience. Well, that's to say, I suppose being torn limb from limb by lions might be worse than that, but don't think we've got any lions here, have we? Incidentally, we could be coming on to lions a little bit later, but I'd like to start off this evening by taking you back just a few years to where it all started. Well, all started for me at any rate. This was the Elliott 803 computer, the very first one that I ever got my sticky paws on when I was still at school. That particular one is the last remaining working example at the National Museum of Computing in Bletchley Park. Well worth going to see, and if you go on a Saturday with a bit of luck, you can see it working, so long as the course door was not playing up. Great machine, we had a lot of fun with that. As you see, the RAM was a mighty 40 kilobytes. Well, to be precise, it was 39 for wee reasons that I shan't go into. The CPU was a serial CPU, which meant that when you added two numbers together, you had a single bit adder and it just fed them in like a zip and it came out at the bottom. The whole thing was built in about 1500 gates, which is about the similar complexity to the Intel 4004 microprocessor, the very first one that came out in, what was it, about 71. The CPU speed was about 1 kiloflop, and the backing store capacity was roughly comparable to a cassette tape. Comms, there was none. Well, that's to say, I think after I finished using the one at Hatfield Tech, as it then was, I think they installed a 75 baud line across to the school next door. So that's where it all started. In terms of security, it never even crossed our minds. If there was anything we were worried about, it might be tearing the last copy of the Algol compiler tape, which is a reel of paper tape about like that, and incurring the wrath of the chief operator. Apart from that, nothing to worry about at all. Moving on about 15 years or so, we come then to the, I don't know, the 70s and 80s, and in the same hall in the National Museum of Computing, there's this 2966. Doesn't actually work, I don't think, but they're working on it. At this time, we were starting to think about multi-access. We had to log in, so we had usernames and passwords. The hardware had to provide assist in order that the operating system could protect itself against undebugged programs. And you had to have a filing system which started to introduce access controls of some sort. In terms of communications, we used to have green screens and remote job entry terminals, and that was about it. So in terms of security, we were making strides, but not very much, and we were already falling well behind the hardware. Things really exploded in the 80s and 90s when two things happened. First of all, the microprocessor revolution really got underway. This is a picture, I believe, of the Pentium chip, which was the first one which really overtook, in terms of raw processing power, the mini computers of their day. And, of course, it hasn't stopped then. That plus the internet really made a fairly lethal combination. The internet, up until that point, as I'm sure all of you know, basically networking was just point-to-point. Somebody came up with the idea of let's chop our information up into little packets, address them individually, chuck them into the cloud, and let them weave their way to their destination. So against that, two dragons, if you like, we've got our maiden in distress, damsel in distress, which is security. Well, security wasn't standing still at that time either, because it was in that sort of period that we had encryption algorithms like DES and AES came along. We had hashing algorithms like SHA and MD5 before it. We had very important Diffie-Hellman key exchange, which was invented, was it in the 70s or the 80s? And along with that, public key cryptography. And without those two, e-commerce as we know it today would be practically impossible, certainly a lot less practicable. So we're making strides in security. That's nothing to the strides we were making in terms of hardware. We started off with the Elliott 803 with a matter of kilobytes of RAM. We're now up to gigabytes of RAM. We started off with the odd megabyte of backing store. We're now up to terabytes. Terabyte costs, I don't know, 50 quid, 100 quid, something like that. And in terms of raw processing power, we're up to gigaflops easily. A current Pentium 4 or whatever it is will do gigaflops. So let's have a look at it in a little bit more detail, what we're doing in terms of security. And the first thing is vulnerabilities. I had to talk a little bit about vulnerabilities. First of all, we've got vulnerabilities in operating systems. These are very troublesome, and as you know, Microsoft comes out every month with a load more operating system patches. In terms of Windows, there was no security at all until Windows NT, which started off with a secure kernel, but even then they hadn't really thought about a secure development life cycle, with the result that we had various exploits. For instance, you've got a buffer which the programmer is sure 100 bytes is going to be big enough for the data that he's going to put in it. So the attacker comes along with 150 bytes, overwrites the whatever is in the store beyond it, and if he can put in maybe 1,050 bytes and overwrite a subroutine return link, he can then cause a jump into some of the information that he's loaded into that buffer. At that point, to use the hacker's vernacular, you're owned, game over. So we got buffer overflows. That's just one example of a case where the where input data has not been properly validated. And that can cause remote code execution if you can get maybe a malicious PDF file to be executed. Maybe you can get that executed and the attacker's code run on the system. Now, one thing that has changed in the last few years, is the emergence of zero-day vulnerabilities. I don't know whether you are familiar with this term. Probably a lot of you are. A few years ago, the typical thing that happened was Microsoft would come out with a patch. Having discovered the vulnerability, the hackers would then reverse engineer the patch and then create exploits for it. The whole thing has turned on its head these days, and the typical thing that very often happens is that the attackers come up with the vulnerability in the first place, and Microsoft is playing catch-up. So you've got a gap of maybe days, maybe weeks, possibly even months, during which time we have got no mitigation to this vulnerability. And that's the zero-day vulnerability, which these days is far too common. So we've got problems in operating systems. We've got problems in applications equally. As you probably know, things like Adobe Reader has been the bane of system administrators' lives in the last few years, in that that has had quite a poor record in terms of security. A lot of that is largely due to simply excessive functionality. The amount of functionality in Adobe Reader, well, if you just see how many megabytes the download is, it's just absolutely phenomenal. And hardly anybody uses more than a tiny fraction of it. So that excess functionality is itself a problem. Then in terms of the web, we've got web vulnerabilities. Again, very often it's excessive functionality which is the problem. These days, if you want to be a web designer, it's no good just learning HTML and a bit of JavaScript, which is where I started off, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago when I first started hacking a bit of a website. These days, there's a whole gamut of technologies, and amongst them, there are a whole load of different problems. Very often, it's again to do with unvalidated input. And apart from the sort of things that we've talked about already, we have SQL injection and we have cross-site scripting, which are particular vulnerabilities in a lot of websites. And with that, a lot of websites on the internet these days are getting hacked and compromised with downloads of malicious software. Then we've got protocol vulnerabilities. A couple of years ago, Dan Kaminsky came up with a serious vulnerability in DNS. And as a result of that, various people these days are rolling out DNSSEC, which is a secure version of DNS. In terms of the routing protocols, the BGP, which is the routing protocol which is used between ISPs and major people serving big pipes on the internet, there's no actual authentication on BGP. And there may be vulnerabilities in that, and that in itself is quite a serious problem. And then, of course, the wetware, you and me. It's been said very often that the biggest vulnerability is between the keyboard and the back of the chair, and that's very true. I imagine most of you are probably familiar with SQL injection and know what it is. For those of you who don't, I've got a little cartoon which you might or might not have seen, and for those who which will illustrate it for those who don't know what it is and amuse those of you who do. Hi, this is your son's school. We're having some computer trouble. Oh dear, did he break something in a way? Did you really name your son Robert, close quotes, close parens, semicolon, drop table students? Oh yes, we call him little Bobby Tables. Sorry, missed one. Well, we've lost this year's student records. I hope you're happy. And I hope you've learned to sanitize your database inputs. So basically, sanitization is the thing that we have to look at all the time and make sure that we sanitize all our inputs in order to avoid a lot of these vulnerabilities. Somebody suggested that you could do the same thing in order to get past speed cameras. I don't think that one would actually work, but it's a nice idea. Okay, so that's the vulnerability side. A vulnerability actually is not a problem at all unless you've got a threat. And if you've got a threat, that's when the vulnerabilities start to come into play. In the public sector, we're encouraged by the risk methodology that we're given to think about threats from two levels. First of all, there's the threat sources. Threat sources are things like crime. Crime doesn't actually attack your system. It's criminals who attack your system. Crime is considered to be a threat source. Likewise, industrial espionage. Foreign intelligence services, likewise, they might attack your system, but they're considered a threat source. Likewise, disaffected users might well be another threat source. So we then think about those threat sources and move on to the threat actors who actually do the dirty. Broadly, we can talk about threat actors in two classes. There's the insiders and the outsiders. The outsiders, theoretically, we ought to be able to keep them at bay because we've got firewalls and all sorts of things like that which should keep them out. The big problem these days is that defining the perimeter. If you can define where the perimeter is, you can keep them out. But these days, with VPNs and people bringing in memory sticks and all sorts, it's very difficult to define the perimeter. So it isn't quite so easy as that. So moving on to the vectors that they use, threat vectors. For instance, we've got malware. In the beginning, the earliest viruses, I'm sure you all know, were basically done as a hobby, just to demonstrate that it could be done, and for kudos amongst the hacking community. These days, it's moved very much across to a criminal activity. We've also got spam, which is a big problem. All to do with selling stuff. And even though spam very often has a very tiny take-up, it's so cheap to send massive quantities of it that it's still worth the spam as well. The next one I've got here is botnets. These days, if you get your computer infected, it's very likely that it's going to be recruited into a network of compromised computers. And this network will be at the beck and call of what we call the bot master. Bot is short for robot. So this bot master can command all these robots to send out more spam or to do a denial of service attack on somebody he doesn't like. Then we've got compromised websites. I mentioned a moment ago. It's very common these days. In fact, there are thousands and thousands of websites, I think maybe even thousands of new ones each day, which are being compromised with drive-by exploits, which if you simply go to that website with a vulnerable browser, you will find you have been perhaps recruited into as yet another member of the botnet. And what complicates all of these things is exploit toolkits. A lot of these exploits have been wrapped up by the criminal fraternity into toolkits. And if you want to pay a few hundred pounds, you can get one of these toolkits, which allows you to set up your own botnets, set up your own spamming run, and hence you can then get into the business yourself. Every now and then, a new virus comes along which actually changes the game. A couple of years ago, it was Conficker, and I'm sure you've all heard of that. And that changed the game because it was the first one, or probably one of the first ones, to successfully blend a variety of several different attacks into a single virus. It could spread via USB sticks, which is how it got into a lot of organizations. It could also spread across the network using a Microsoft vulnerability, and it could share spread via network shares. Having those multiple methods of propagation made it extremely efficient and extremely virulent. In the last few weeks, you've probably heard about the Stuxnet worm, which again is something of a game changer. Basically, these zero-day vulnerabilities, the criminal fraternity normally value those very highly, and they will use them very sparingly. The unique thing about Stuxnet is that it contained four previously unknown zero-day vulnerabilities, which indicates that it wasn't just a commoner garden criminal gang. It also used two stolen code signing certificates. And strangely enough, both those certificates were traced back to the same industrial park in South Korea. Interesting. And finally, as I'm sure you've all heard, it targeted industrial control plants. Now, I'm sure you've heard a lot of speculation about that. What I've told you is all that's known about fact, all that's known as fact. And all the other speculation that you've heard is basically just that, speculation, because we don't know what it is, and we probably never know. We'll know where it came from or what it was really intended to do. It's caused a lot of discussion about cyber warfare and things like that. My view of that is, well, one of the more sober commentaries on it that I heard was, if this is cyber warfare, we haven't got too much to worry about, have we? I think it has been grossly overblown. And when you think about it, China is not going to come in and blow up our power grid. I heard the other day, I don't know whether it's true, I've got no reason to doubt it, that apparently there's never been a war between two countries, both of which have a McDonald's in their capital. China needs us to buy all those iPods they're manufacturing, and we need them to buy all those cheap goods they're manufacturing. They're not going to take our national grid out. The sort of people who might want to, things like Al-Qaeda, well, A, they don't have that level of technology, and B, well, basically, they like things that go bang and leave blood on the streets. Things like Stuxnet, which just beavers away in the background, is no good to them at all. On the plus side, if you, on the one hand, you were to create or gain the technology to create a weapon of mass destruction, if you can make 100 of them, you can deploy 100 of them. If you find a zero-day vulnerability, you can deploy it once. And after a few weeks, the vendors will get onto it, and it's much less use to you anymore. However, on the negative side, nobody really knows what Stuxnet has done. Nobody really knows how far it's penetrated. If you think about it, if you were able to contaminate one jar of baby food within the supply chain, basically all the supermarkets would have to take all the jars of baby food off all the shelves on all the supermarkets. So with a very small investment, you've caused the industry to spend a lot of money in order to clean it up. And that could even be just what Stuxnet is trying to do. May have created very little actual damage, but just trying to clean it up and finding out just where it is actually a pretty large investment. So basically, it can simply degrade confidence and cause indirect costs. So as I say, a threat isn't a problem. A vulnerability isn't a problem. The problem comes when the two join up together. So a risk, basically, is a vulnerability, the intersection of a vulnerability and a threat. And the sort of risks that we're talking about are data loss. For instance, it's a big deal if we lose personal data these days. It was a very major deal when HMRC lost two CDs two or three years ago. If you lose personal data, it can lead to distress to individuals. It can lead to ID theft. In a commercial concept, in a commercial arena, it can lead to loss of competitive edge. If it's security data, it can potentially lead to a national security problem. And your imagination can probably think of a few things there. The second one is fraud. Basically, if you can get into, for instance, a financial system and twiddle some of the figures, maybe twiddle a payee's bank number, obviously you can divert funds. And so that's a risk that we concerned ourselves with, fraud. Then the next one is denial of service. If I've got a botnet and I use it to swamp maybe a gambling site, I can extort money out of that gambling site. And that has been done, and it has commonly been done. So denial of service has been done and is commonly done for commercial gain. It's also been done for political reasons, and you've probably heard of the attacks on the Ukraine parliament and various websites in the Ukraine. Nobody knew whether it actually came from the Russian government or just people sympathising with the Russian government. So it can be political. It can also be activists. Just recently, there was a denial of service attack on some of the recording industry websites by some of the people who are upset about the recording industry going after piracy. So it can be used by activists as well. And possibly, in many cases, one of the most damaging risks that we suffer or run is reputational damage. I've already mentioned the HMRC incident, and that caused, well, nobody is aware that anybody was materially damaged by that, as far as I know. But the big thing that has changed as a result of that is government policy that's caused a complete sea change in government policy in order to cope with that, a complete rethink of it. And that is largely because of the reputational damage. In a commercial environment, it takes years to build up a reputation, and it can be destroyed in a matter of a day. So we've got these risks, and what are we going to do about them? Basically, a risk is the intersection of a vulnerability and a threat. And if we multiply the risk, maybe, of losing £1 million with the likelihood, say we decide that there's a likelihood of 1 in 100 of that happening in any one year, then it's worth spending 100th of that £1 million in order to mitigate that risk. So that is the impact that we then can calculate, and hence work out our mitigation budget. So we then put in place what we call controls, which reduce the vulnerability, they can reduce the threat, they can reduce the likelihood, or they can reduce the impact. You can reduce the vulnerability by patching your software. You can reduce the threat maybe by putting a firewall in place to keep the people out. You can reduce the likelihood. Well, that might be the same as reducing the threat, or it might be putting fresh air between the threat and the vulnerability. And you can reduce the impact, maybe by taking backups, so that if you do lose your data, you can easily get it back. So these controls come in three different flavours. The easiest and the simplest to understand is physical controls, and that is obviously things like card locks on your doors, Kensington locks on your laptops, night watchmen, all that sort of thing. Those are easy to understand and easy to deploy. More interesting ones are the ones that a lot of us probably get excited about, and that is the technical controls, all your firewalls, antivirus, two-factor authentication, file permissions. A whole industry is built up around those things. And then the third one is your procedural or personnel controls. And this is like things like security operating procedures, acceptable use policies, advice on password handling and data handling, staff vetting is an important one. And if all that fails, you will have a disciplinary procedure, and that is the long stop of your procedural controls. So if you have a complete set of controls and you choose a good selection from those three categories, then hopefully you should have a reasonably secure system. So we understand risks composed of threats, and vulnerabilities. We know how to multiply the by the likelihood in order to get the impact, and hence we can calculate the controls, what our budget for the controls, and we have three different kinds of controls. We could put it all together and we can mitigate our risk. Should be all right then, shouldn't it? But it isn't. So where have we gone wrong? Well, I started off by taking you back to the 60s. I'd like to take you back just a little bit further than that. In the 16th century, when the Spanish conquistadors, this is before the Information Age, when they went out to South America and conquered all the indigenous people, it was said that they went out motivated by God, glory, and gold. Well, I'm sure they didn't find my God, and they didn't find any kind of glory that I would recognize as glory, but they certainly found gold. When they conquered the Incas, as a king's ransom, I believe they exacted 11 tons of the stuff, plus twice as much in silver to boot. And then they murdered the king anyway. They took all that back to Spain. And did it do them any good? Well, of course it did them good in the short term. But what it did basically was that it meant that money was so plentiful that it lost its value. You could say maybe that they only saw the gold. They knew the price of everything, but the value of nothing. The result was hyperinflation, and after the money was all spent, Spain lost its position as an international power and has never regained it properly since. Wouldn't it be better if all that gold had come in dribs and drabs, and if they'd spent it much more slowly and discreetly to build up infrastructure, maybe alleviate poverty and things like that, and maybe they could have then made it do some real lasting good? I think there's a parallel there. Is Moore's Law the conquistador's gold of the Information Age? That's an interesting thing to think about and discuss in the pub afterwards, maybe. In the last 30, 40 years, we've had an absolute glut of computing power. Communication bandwidth has gone through the roof. Computing power has gone through the roof. Storage has gone through the roof. And we haven't known none what to do with it. When I was playing around with the Elliott 803, I would have given my eye teeth for half the CPU cycles that are spent by Microsoft Word animating that silly little paperclip. Wouldn't it be better, perhaps, have been better, maybe if Moore's Law had gone at half or quarter of the speed? Maybe we would have then been able to write some code which was actually a bit more secure. We would have spent time cramming it into the available space. And we would have thought a lot more carefully about it. You could say that we know the price of every terabyte, about 50 quid, but do we know the value of the data that we put in it? Perhaps we've lost sight of that. So we've created this horrendous behemoth, and do we understand the beast that we've created? A bit like the sorcerer's apprentice, who couldn't understand how to control the thing that he had created. There's a parallel here, I think, in the financial crisis in the last couple of years. Everybody assumed that all these financial instruments worked, but they were so complicated that nobody really understood them. Nobody could calculate their risk exposure, and it all came tumbling down like a house of cards. The risk that the same thing is going to happen in the security area. One of the problems that we've got is that hardly any of us, probably none of us, fully understand these days the trust model. For instance, I don't know whether you know, but some months ago, the Mozilla Foundation, which obviously produces the Firefox browser, they accepted into their root certificate store the root certificate for CNNIC, which is the Chinese Internet Authority. That means, in principle, the Chinese government can turn your browser bar green. You happy about that? Not sure that I am. And when I tell you that apparently last Sunday, I haven't heard corroboration of this, but apparently it was repeated, it was reported on CNET. For a period of 17 minutes, there was a glitch in internet routing. A and a large proportion of the entire internet traffic disappeared into China. Now, glitches in internet routing aren't that rare. It's happened before. Normally, when it happens, the data goes into a black hole, it's never seen again. The strange thing about it this time was that it disappeared into China, and it all came out again and went on to its destination. Are you happy about that? You understand the trust model? I'm not sure that I am. Then, of course, there's the human factors. How are we at assessing risk? I think most of us would agree that as humans, we're not very good at assessing risk at all. Well, actually, in a sense, I would beg to disagree. Our risk assessment instincts were honed by a million years of evolution on the African savanna. There's one snag, we don't live on the African savanna anymore. So basically, we still use that risk assessment, those instincts, to assess our risk. On the African savanna, basically, there was nothing you could have told those people, our ancestors, about avoiding snakes or getting eaten by crocodiles or caught by lions. I told you I'd come onto the lions eventually. These days, our risks are completely different, and yet you still use the same instincts. So I thought to myself, let's write down the rules of risk assessment that we used to use then and we still tend to use today and see how they stack up. So basically, I wrote down three rules. Rule number one, threats are simple. If there are no lions in view and there's nowhere for them to lurk, don't worry about lions. Okay, the trouble is now, today, threats are no longer simple. Threats can get extremely complicated, and very often we don't understand them. We don't see where they're coming from, and we have a lot of invisible threats which can easily catch us out. So that rule is pretty well useless. Rule number two, we're smarter than lions and a lot smarter than snakes. Just worry about people when their demeanour is threatening. Well, okay, there are a lot of things today without human faces which we can't outsmart. Even the things that do have human faces, like hackers, we don't see the human faces, and hence we still treat them like dumb threats that we can still outsmart. And a lot of threats are smarter than we are, and we hence tend to underestimate them. Okay, so that's two down. We haven't won one yet. Rule number three, if you're in control of a situation, you can probably hack it. The time to worry is if you're injured and you can't run or you're outnumbered by a rival tribe. Well, today there are plenty of situations which are far too complicated for us to control. It's a matter of control. If you control the situation, you feel that you can hack it. And conversely, there are other situations that we're not in control of, we don't need to worry about because somebody else competent is in control of them. The classic example is our attitude to flying versus driving. Now, quite a fair number of people are scared of flying, and yet they're quite happy to drive as far as you like in a car, even though all the statistics indicate that driving is far more dangerous than flying. So apparent control of a situation is a very poor indicator of the risk. So to sum up, basically, we build a mental model of the threat landscape and we build our risk assessment on that threat model. In the case of the African savanna, the threat model, our internal perception of the threat and the actual threat were probably pretty closely aligned. And we could manage perfectly well. But these days, our perception of the threat and the reality of the threat, or the feeling and the reality, can differ very widely. And that is the cause of a lot of our problems. And more than that, different stakeholders will have very often different perceptions of the threat. For instance, if you're a project manager, what are you worried about? Missing a deadline. If you're a security consultant like me, what are you worried about? Well, the last thing you went on a course about, maybe you went on a course on Wi-Fi security, and you're dead scared about people driving out and parking outside and scanning your wireless networks. Supposing you're the legal director of the company, what are you scared about then? You're scared about compliance. If you're the CEO, you're scared about loss of reputation. All those risks are perfectly valid, but each of those different stakeholders has a different view of the risk. And the challenge is to merge them and find out and determine which are the biggest risks and to not just to address your risk that you perceive, but to address the whole risk landscape in a holistic way. The way in which the feeling and the reality of security is rather well demonstrated in a paper which I think it was is apparently Professor John Adams, who's Emeritus Professor of Geography at London University, I think it was, University College London. And he wrote a paper called What Kills You Matters. That paper contains a very nice little diagram in which he rates different kinds of risks. At the top, he's got pure risks like, well, if you're into rock climbing, then you accept the risk of rock climbing relatively readily. Basically, you're in control and it's something you do voluntarily. Where your control is diminished, like for instance, cycling, okay, you've got all these lorries whizzing past you at 90 miles an hour and you feel less safe, you're less apt to accept the risk. Where you've got no control, like in a plane or a train, there again, you're much, much less tolerant of the risk. He puts neutral things like natural disasters, earthquakes and volcanoes in the middle, and then imposed risks, things that have imposed upon you, he puts at the bottom in the area which he describes as risk amplification. Benign things like mobile phone masks, we're not too happy about. If it's profit motivated, like GM crops, we're perhaps less happy about. And if it's actually malign, like Al-Qaeda, well, we just have no tolerance for that whatsoever. Even though probably as many people were killed on the roads last week as were killed in 7/7, because it's a malign thing that comes out of the blue like that. Not that I would want for a moment to diminish the grief of the people who died and were affected by 7/7, but is it really any greater than the grief of maybe somebody killed in a road accident? And yet we class it right down at the bottom. And road accidents we're really very tolerant of. Another area where the perception and the reality of risk is interesting to look at is in personal information. Do we really understand personal information? Well, the Data Protection Act is perfectly clear. It does what it says on the tin. We know what personal information is from the data protection point of view. But I have to ask, is it still the right tin? Basically, DPA was written in days which predated social networking. It predated geolocation. It predated a lot of web browser tracking. It predated very largely RFID tags. And these are all things that people tend to worry about. And in my view, I think data protection is coming up for a major overhaul in the next few years. On the one hand, Mark Zuckerberg is on record as saying that privacy is no longer the social norm. Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? Because his business model depends on it. But so many people share incredible amounts of information on the internet, on Facebook. On the other hand, when Google drives around the streets with a camera on the top, and in particular when people realise that they were actually collecting Wi-Fi data, there's a huge outcry. Well, if you had a Wi-Fi hotspot in your house and it's not encrypted, you're literally shouting your usernames and passwords from the rooftops. And if that gets picked up by Google, well, whose fault is that? Google's? Hardly. Basically, it's a question of perception again. We see the risk of Facebook as low because it's something we're familiar with. But when this car goes round the streets with this funny camera on the top, we're not very happy about that at all. So there's a question of whether data protection still matches the perception of risk. We're worried about collection of browsing habits. When Form was rolled out as a trial by BT a year or two ago, there was a huge outcry over that, even though they deliberately took steps to make sure that they weren't collecting personal data. On the one hand, people are worried about that, but how many people have got in their wallets a whole gamut of store loyalty cards, which are basically collecting the same sort of information about your shopping habits? Okay, it's your shopping habits, not your browsing habits, but it's just the same sort of thing at the end of the day. And if you go into Sainsbury's, the one near to your mistress, and buy a bottle of wine for her or something, then Sainsbury's knows that you've been into that branch of Sainsbury's. So basically, it's an issue of control. Our store loyalty cards, they're safe in our wallets. We've got those under control. We think that they're safe. But what the ISP or Google does with our browsing habits, well, we've no idea what they're doing with them. Yet another example is CCTV cameras. We're very actually tolerant of thousands of CCTV cameras which have sprung up across the country in recent years. And yet, talk about RFID tags and people start getting twitchy. So does it match the perception of personal risk, and should it? So how are we going to actually fix data protection? Well, I haven't got the answers here, but I've got a few questions which I think we probably need to think about as this discussion heads off. First of all, does it match the citizens' needs and does it match their desires? There's a fundamental question here which actually applies to a lot of lawmaking. To what extent should we protect the citizens from themselves, even when they have no desire themselves to protect themselves? And on the other hand, to what extent should we pander to the citizens' desires and fears, even though they may be unfounded? And we've got to have that discussion and see where we want to find the balance between them. Then another aspect, I think, is we're probably going to need to look at greater granularity of personal information. At the moment, the Data Protection Act recognises two levels. There's ordinary personal data, like names and addresses, and the sensitive personal data, like medical history, sexual orientation, political views, things like that. I think the time will come when we may have to think about still more levels. I think it was Bruce Schneier who recently, in a blog posting, analysed all the information that people commonly share in Facebook, and he came up with about half a dozen different categories of personal information which you might want to control in different ways. And the third thing I think we need to think about is privacy versus secrecy. We tend to confuse those two. Privacy is not secrecy. The PIN code to my bank account is secret. I'm not telling anybody that. My wife doesn't even know that, and I don't know my wife's. That is secret. But my date of birth, that on the other hand is private. I don't tell everybody because somebody might be able to use it as a component to ID theft or something like that. But I will share it where I need to, where I want to. In particular, if I think somebody's going to buy me a birthday present, I might share it with them. But that is private. That is not secret. And we have to understand and probably recognise within data protection the difference between them. And the difference basically is control. And one of the key things that we're going to have to face up to is how we control our personal information. I mentioned Bruce Schneier again just a moment again, and he came up with another interesting idea in a blog post recently. He said that in the last couple of centuries, the bosses, the captains of industry, built up an industrial society with virtually no regard for pollution. And now we're paying the price and trying to clean up. And he's suggesting, is data the pollution of the information age? It's an interesting thought. We got all this information, and it's just turning into unquantifiable and uncontrollable data. And one of these days, we're going to have to clean it up, just as we've had to clean up ordinary type of pollution. Another thing you might like to discuss over a pint in the pub afterwards. Okay, so I've covered a lot of problems, and I haven't given you any answers. Well, I don't think I've got any answers, but I might have a few ideas as to where you might start thinking about some answers and how we can make it easier. Well, I've got about six or eight of these. Some of them are just one-liners, a couple which are a little bit more meaty. The first one is we've got to think about our security management strategies. And in my work, I think I've detected three different levels of security management. The first one I call fly swatting. Now, shortly after I graduated, I went out to Sri Lanka and I spent a very enjoyable year there teaching these kids A-level maths and physics. Great place to be, beautiful country, enjoyed myself thoroughly. One of the slight inconveniences was the mosquitoes. Well, I made myself a little game out of this. With a little bit of practice and with a bit of sharp reactions, you can catch them in mid-air like that. You open your hand. My game was, if it squashes black, it's one up to me. If it squashes red, it's one up to them. The trouble is we tend to do security management in the same sort of way. There's a risk. Oh, got that one. There's another risk. Got that one. The trouble is there's always another one, and it's probably behind you. And worse still, some of them squash red. So that's not very good, and yet you see it happening all the time. The second level, which is a little bit better, is the checklist level. You have a checklist of all these controls, best practice controls, and you go down the list, and about 3 weeks later, you come out of the bottom of the list, and you've done all those, and you think you're safe. Well, probably you're not. For one thing, you might have actually implemented something that you didn't need. And for another thing, you might have implemented something without thinking about the risk, and so you haven't actually addressed the risk. So you have a false sense of security. And PCI DSS, which all the security industry dealing with payment cards has to comply with, that is basically a checklist. And that is my argument with PCI DSS, that it is good, it's a good checklist mainly, but it gives you a false sense of security if you just look at the checklist. So that leaves us just with a proper way of doing it, and that is proper risk management. I've in fact given you most of the theory of that. We look at our vulnerabilities, we look at our threat sources, we look at our threats, and we combine them in order to find our risks. We try and measure or estimate our threats and our vulnerabilities, perhaps on a high, medium, low scale, or if we're really sophisticated, maybe a scale of 1 to 5 or something like that. And hence we put them all into a big matrix. We then estimate the likelihood of any of those things coming out and come out with the impact of all our different threats. And we can put them into a nice sorted list with our biggest threat or our biggest risk at the top and top, and the ones we don't really care about down at the bottom. That is basically how ISO 27001 asks you to do it, and it's how the government security policy requires you to do it these days as well. And that is basically the only way to do it. And yet, so many times we don't actually do that. Okay, so that's the first thing that we can do to make it a little easier if we can, is to have a proper risk management strategy. A final word on that, basically, you've got all these numbers and you feed them into a matrix. The important thing is not that you've been able to estimate terribly accurately any of those risks, but at least you sat down and thought about it. And sitting down and thinking about it is probably the biggest value of the whole process. Okay, we've got our mental model of risk and the actual model, which tends to be out of kilter very often. And it is very difficult to challenge those mental models. If a person has a mental model, a mental idea of what the risk is, it's actually quite difficult to challenge that and to change their ideas. And one of the ways that you can do it, if you can at all, is with what we call a flashbulb experience. Now, I believe Napoleon is reported to have said that it's a good idea to shoot one of your generals from time to time in order to encourage the others. Well, that would make you think a little bit, wouldn't it? I'm not suggesting we shoot one or two of our users from time to time to encourage the others, though I should imagine some of us might like to do that sometimes. I haven't got any simple ways as to how you construct one of these flashbulb experiences, but I think if we can do that and look out for opportunities to do that at any time that we can, then that is our main, one of our main ways of getting the message across. The next thing I've written down is you've got to understand economics or you'll never understand security. A lot of the problems that we face are at root economic problems. Spam is essentially an economic problem. And there are several interesting economic theories which throw light on these. I don't know whether we've got time to go through. I'll certainly talk about the first one. And that is called the market for lemons. I don't know whether anybody's heard of that. Have you ever tried buying a second-hand Fiesta? Supposing you want, don't know why anybody would want to buy one of those. Supposing you want to buy a five-year-old second-hand Fiesta. You look in market in Auto Trader and you find that they go from £1,000 up to £2,000. So what do? You're not going to buy the £2,000 one because you don't know it's any good. It might be a fantastic little car, but you don't know. You might have wasted your money. It might turn out to be a lemon. So you don't go for that one. Likewise, the £1,000 car, you don't go for that because it's almost certainly going to be a lemon. It might be a fantastic bargain, but you don't know. It's probably going to be a lemon. So what do? You spend £1,500 on a car and go for one bang in the middle. And everybody does that. So what happens? The chap with a really good Fiesta at £2,000 can't get a decent price for it. So what does he do? He withdraws from the market and he gives it to his teenagers to learn to drive on, or decides just to run it into the ground. With the result that you've got now, you've got Fiestas on the market from £1,500 down to £1,000, medium ones at £1,500 ones, and lemons at £1,000. So what does everybody do? Don't want to buy the expensive one, don't want to buy the cheap one, buy for one at £1,250. Thereupon, the chap with a £1,500 half-decent Fiesta can't get a decent price for it, and he withdraws from the market, gives it to his teenagers to learn to drive on, or runs it into the ground, with the result that you've just got all the Fiestas on the market are lemons. Do you identify with that at all? There is a parallel here. Basically, the problem there is this disparity between the information available to the buyer and the information available to the seller. The seller knows much more about his product than the buyer does, with the result that if he's got a really good product, he can't get a decent price for it, with the result that there's very little incentive to produce a really good product if you can't show that it is a good product. So, for instance, if you're producing a really good firewall, has all the bells and whistles, has all the latest technology, but you can't actually persuade people that it is a really good firewall worth twice as much as the other one. All of the punter can actually judge on is bells and whistles. He can see all the fancy facilities that it's got, and he can judge on that. So people tend to buy in terms of fancy facilities. You can't judge whether it's a good firewall or a bad one, so there's no incentive for the industry to produce really good firewalls. The way around this, if there is one, is certification schemes. So if you produce a really good firewall, if you get it certified under common criteria or something like that, and there are several schemes, then you can actually prove to the market that you have got a product which is somewhat better than the average. The same way, if the guy with a £2,000 Fiesta, if he goes to the trouble of getting an AA report on it, he can probably get his price for it. So there are various schemes for encryption products. There's the CAPS scheme and there's FIPS 140. In other areas, there's things like CCTM, which is governed by CESG in Cheltenham. Various schemes. And it's up to us as purchasers, if we can support those schemes, we can actually help the industry to have an incentive to produce really good products. And without that, basically, there's no incentive and we will have to put up with lemons all the time. There's another theory that I'm not sure that we've got time to go into. Basically, it's called the tragedy of the commons. If you type tragedy of the commons into into Wikipedia. There's a good article on it there. Basically, here again is a question of disparity of interest. Basically, in a situation like, for instance, where you've got some common ground and everybody is putting their sheep on it to graze, it's in the interest of any individual to put one or two extra sheep on there, because the benefit of that goes to the individual, but the cost of that, the overgrazing, is borne by the whole community. And spam is a classic example of that. Basically, all the benefits go to the individual and all the costs go to the community. And unless we could break that model, we're never actually going to defeat spam. Externality is another example of this. If the bank can persuade you to be responsible for the losses if your account is compromised, then the bank will have no incentive whatsoever to keep your to give you a secure bank account. So market economics basically governs a lot of these things. And there's a very good example of that. About 5 years ago, there was an outfit, I think it was an Israeli outfit called Blue Security, which nearly got a handle on the problem of spam. Very interesting. Basically what they did, they produced a little plugin that you could connect to Outlook or Thunderbird or whatever your email client was, which would you could point your latest spam at it, and it would analyze it. It would send it off to Blue Security. They would analyze it, and all spam actually relies on there being a route back to the originator, because they want you to buy their Viagra pills or whatever. So Blue Security would analyze this, work out what the route back to the originator was, which is probably an email address or something like that, and send that information back to everybody's plugins in their email clients, with the result that the next person who then got that same spam, basically it would then pop up a button which you could click. One click, you could send a message to the spammer saying, no, thank you. Well, basically, that changed the game for the spammers. Because normally, they reply on the people not being interested, just ignoring it and deleting it. So they never get normally get people saying, no, thank you. And all the replies they get are actually leads that they can take up. So it changes the game so that now they've got these thousands of people with all their no thank yous coming in, and it starts to cost them actually to filter through them and to find the ones that actually are leads. Well, maybe if it had taken off, they could have used themselves anti-spamming techniques in order to filter out all those no thank yous. But in fact, they were sufficiently rattled that a certain group of spammers launched an absolutely devastating denial of service attack on Blue Security and drove them out of business. Basically, there were other websites co-located on the same servers or the same ISP, which were also knocked off the web at the same time as collateral damage. And in view of that, Blue Security decided that they had to give up. Great shame. Be interesting to know what would have happened if somebody like Microsoft had taken that idea and run with it. Hopefully, the spammers wouldn't have been able to take Microsoft off the net. As I say, it's always an arms battle, and I'm not sure that it would have been the final solution. In fact, almost certainly it would have. But you can see from the fact that the spammers were sufficiently rattled that it actually was an idea that had legs for a little while. So basically, you've got to understand economics. Otherwise, you'll never understand security. The next few are, I think, the last few are basically mainly one-liners, I think. First of all, understand the user. Don't hack him off. There are times when we're dealing with high security systems and the controls have to be very onerous, and yes, they are going to be very tedious, and people have got to remember long passwords and do this and do that and all sorts of things, and it will be very difficult. But there is a tendency so often for people just to throw in these security controls without sufficient regard for usability. Basically, we need the user on our side, and if we hack him off, then we will immediately lose him, and we will lose the battle. And as soon as we lose the battle, he'll start looking for ways around the controls that we try and put in place. The next one is an old one. Keep it simple, stupid. Complexity is the enemy of security. We built up these incredibly complex systems, and very often we don't really understand them anymore. And that is one of the big problems that we've got. Sometimes we put layer upon layer upon layer of security, and we call it security defense in depth. But then have we thought too much about how those layers actually interact? And sometimes they don't. It's what we used to call a binding problem. You might have one security control over here, which basically doesn't interact properly or interacts badly with some other control. And so we have to think about that. And then I guess the next one is think like an attacker. I'm sure I'm not the only person in this room who was trained as an engineer. Engineers are trained to make things work. You get this thing, whatever it is, to work, then you heave it over the fence to the production department, you go home happy. The attackers have a radically different viewpoint. They're interested in making it break, because in the failure modes, that is where they are likely to be able to find ways of exploiting it to their own advantage. So when we manufacture or design anything, we need to think very carefully about the failure modes. And it's not just if you're designing software. Even in procedures, supposing you're designing a password reset so that when somebody forgets his password, they ring up in order to get it reset. Well, there's a procedure which an attacker will look at, and he will say, well, what are the steps in that procedure and how can I break that procedure? And that is how he will actually circumvent or break that procedure. The next one, I think we've talked about a certain amount, policy must evolve. We've talked about how data protection maybe is coming to the end of its sell-by date. We've got to think about, is it still relevant? As I say, I work largely in the public sector, in government and defence. And I sometimes wonder whether CESG, which governs all that sort of thing, is occasionally still fighting the Cold War. Some of the things they ask us to do, you really wonder to yourself, well, yeah, okay, if it's top secret and it's got lives dependent on it, yes. But if it's basically just, I don't know, a stores management system like the one that Siva and I were working on, does it really need that level of control? Does it really need, I don't know, encryption, which has been specially tailored rather than ordinary AES? And so we need to think about, well, particularly in this time of cuts, when we're all being asked to do more with less, and we need to see basically whether our policy is still appropriate to the risks that we're looking at. And just as policy needs to evolve, so does strategy have to evolve. For instance, how do we tackle malware? Some people have suggested maybe we should subvert some of these botnets and then turn them to our own use in order to clean things up. Well, I think that's a bit like fighting fire with fire. But maybe we need to think a little bit more laterally. For instance, the law enforcement authorities are circumscribed in what they do, in as much as they're not allowed to log on to your computer in order to clean it up. Basically, the Computer Misuse Act prevents them doing that. The bad guys don't mind doing it. So why shouldn't the law enforcement people do that? Basically, criminals carry guns, and wouldn't it be nice if the police didn't have to carry guns? But because the criminals carry guns, the police have to carry guns as well. So maybe we need to think about this a little bit more deeply and see how we can. Obviously, we're going to need a lot of checks and balances, just as with the police carrying guns. There are a lot of controls in place there. Microsoft recently, you might have heard, has started talking about whether we should have require people to have some sort of health certificate on their PC before they go online. In the United States, you have to have a valid immunization certificate before you can go to school. Why shouldn't you be required to have some sort of certificate before you can go onto the internet? Basically, internet access is a privilege, and we need to accept the responsibilities of that and make sure that people do accept the responsibility of doing that. And so I think basically that is another idea that we're going to have to think quite a lot about in the years to come. Okay, so that just about wraps it up. We started in the 1960s, perhaps before one or two of us were born. We then moved back to the 16th century, and we've come right up to date and thought about one or two of the things that we might have to think about in the future. And to wrap up, I'm reminded of the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. And we certainly live in interesting times. Thank you. You've been a very attentive and quiet audience. Perhaps I haven't given you time to answer questions because I was concerned that I might overrun maybe a little bit, but not too much. If you've got any questions, preferably easy ones, then there's a microphone which is going round. Perhaps if you can put your hand up.
Just to share something with you, because you were talking about the ideal solution is risk management. We used to have in MOD a strategy of not taking any risk, and then we decided that was untenable. Yes. So we went to the balanced strategy. And then the second iteration, you mentioned 27001, which evolved from 7799, and part of that is the philosophy of plan, do, check, act.
Yes.
Whereas you analyze the situation, you take all the reasonable measures, and then you're guided by circumstance. But I suggest another rule of the savannah. If it hasn't happened, it never will. If it has happened, it will again. So I asked somebody, what was the purpose of Plan, Do, Check, Act? And the answer was, to make sure it never happens again.
Yes.
Wrong. Now, if the risk hasn't changed, your reaction shouldn't have changed.
Yes, good point. Yes, thank you for that.
But, you know, it depends upon a very sophisticated understanding of risk by the risk manager. And unfortunately, we are guided by risk managers who just don't have it.
No, absolutely. So often you go into a situation and you're doing risk management for an organisation and you have a list of risks and you go in front of these people, and to get a government system accredited, you have to go to the stakeholders and get them to go through this list of risks. And they say, I don't know. And you end up doing it yourself. And you think to yourself, terrorists, well, low. Hackers, well, put something medium in there. And basically you end up, even though you're supposed to be asking the stakeholders what their perception of risk is, very often they haven't got a clue, and you have to, with your own professional judgment, you have to make a lot of it up for them and say, do you agree with that? And they'll very often say, yeah, that's about right.
Relating to your comments about information and the incontinence that people treat it with nowadays, there's been recent suggestions that a coming-of-age ceremony now could consist of identity change, so that you could lose all that embarrassing posting on Facebook when you go out into the job market. Do you have any thoughts on that area?
I think that's a very valid point, and that's one that a lot of young people don't realise. And basically, once you put something on the internet, it's basically eternal. And it's not a new problem. With the old-fashioned Usenet news groups, a lot of people probably were fairly prodigal in terms of what they put on those. And there are cases of people who've maybe postings that they put on Usenet years and years ago, a potential employer digs around and well, okay, if there's John Smith, you can't really tell that it was the same John Smith. But if you've got a name like me, well, there aren't many of us on the internet. And if I said something indiscreet 30 years ago at the beginning of the internet, it's probably still there. Yeah, so it's a good point.
Is there any evidence that the lack of security for online transactions, for example, is inhibiting people using such systems for business? Certainly puts me off.
Amongst John Joe Public, well, I wouldn't like to say I'm any kind of expert on it. This is just my opinion. There doesn't seem to be. We got a lot of talk about identity theft and so on. But basically, most people say, well, it's never happened to me, and I don't know anybody who it has happened to. Well, probably if you looked amongst your friends of friends, you might well find somebody that it has happened to. But it basically comes down to the problem. If it hasn't happened, then it won't happen. And there's quite a lot of education to be done there, I think, as we move forward.
I've heard on occasion people offering an insurance model as a way of trying to manage security in another way, so that companies have to insure or take insurance out, and then insurance companies, because they're having to pay out money, would then force things either back to the supplier or onto the consumer. Have you got thoughts?
Yes, I don't know. I haven't heard of that one. It could work. I don't know. But when you think about health insurance, basically if you start to get ill, then it's very difficult to get health insurance. And I don't know whether the same sort of problems might arise there if, I don't know, somebody in your household got infected badly. Is that going to affect your insurance premiums? And the other thing I think is that insurers tend to be very wary of risks which are not random. For instance, the classic example is the millennium bug. Insurers wouldn't touch that because if it happened to one person, it would happen to everybody. And maybe if the son of Conficker came round, maybe the insurers would have to say, well, sorry, we're not going to insure things like that, which would probably neutralise it from the beginning. So, yes, it's an interesting idea. Whether it work in practice, I think we'd have to think about that.
You made an intriguing reference earlier in your talk to the insider threat. This was one of the three major things that Ian Lobham stressed in his recent speech around cyber and cybersecurity and all that sort of stuff. Would you care to expand a bit more on your views about the insider threat?
Yes, that's interesting. The basic problem is the insider threat. There is no ultimately defence against it. Basically, you can partition your systems as best you can so that if an insider does run wild, he can only get so far. But actually, most systems have grown up, and this is actually incredibly difficult to partition it. The other thing that we do is obviously vetting. But there again, all the best spies have top-level clearances. So that actually doesn't necessarily help. It no doubt helps somewhat. But, well, there's a case fairly recently of somebody working, what was it, working in Iraq, was it? I forget the details. And he got a whole load of information, what was it, intelligence signals, and he put them on Wikipedia, on WikiLeaks. Well, there again, we can control a lot of those things with best practice. That chap should never have been allowed to write anything to a CD. That's just plain bad practice. So the first level is to follow best practice as far as we can. Then, I don't know. Well, at the end of the day, you can't put a firewall on a person. It's the ultimate risk. As I said, there's the biggest risk is between the keyboard and the back of the chair, and it's always going to be that way. We can mitigate it to some extent, but we're going to have a Burgess and McLean sometime.
A lot of work is being done on behavioural modelling to detect when someone's behaviour diverges from the norm. That might be the future, but it's not really there yet.
Yes, that is a good point. And in fact, in the government vetting regime, one of the things they talk about is aftercare. So you don't just give somebody this particular clearance and that's that. You are supposed to, the vetting authority then has to follow them up and make sure that, well, I'm not sure how much it happens. But when I give my security talk to people around here, I talk about vetting and I say to them, look, if any of your friends, anybody around here, round you, any of your colleagues, you get the impression they're having a hard time. Well, in this company we have, a lot of other companies probably have this free helpline that you can ring up confidentially, and you can tell people to ring that up. And basically, if you start getting problems, you can manage them if you use the appropriate means. But I heard it said once that basically three disasters can put practically anybody onto the streets. I don't know. You have a redundancy. Maybe your marriage breaks up. Maybe you have an alcohol problem or a health problem. Three things like that. Can pretty well put you on, any one of us, is a sobering thought, could possibly put any one of us onto the streets.
I'd like, if I may, to ask the origin of the model of risk that you presented. Presumably it's a government model, because it actually goes quite contrary to the traditional statistician's model of risk, which inverts the impact and risk terms on the right-hand side of the equation. And I'm wondering how it's arisen, because it doesn't make statistical sense. Traditionally, risk is the product of an outcome and a likelihood or probability. Okay. And what you have is that is the impact, and the risk is the product of a threat and a possibly an incidence. But it seems awfully confused compared with the well-established and fundamentally valid statistical model of risk, which is likelihood multiplied by outcome.
Okay, well, 2 points there. One is that this model, basically, having thought about it, came out of my head, and the terms mainly came out of my head. So that's where it came from. So if it's not the statistical terms, then that's because I'm not a statistician. But I think the basic principles are reasonably valid. And basically, that model, I developed it when we were doing a 27001 certification in this place that I was involved with. And I had to invent a risk management management methodology, and that is basically the elements of the methodology that I used. If it uses the wrong term, sorry. And the other thing basically is that statistics doesn't always apply to this. A couple of years ago, I was talking to a guy who does risk management in chemical plants. Now there, you can say, well, okay, we got a valve, and we got thousands of these things, and we know what the MMTBF is, and we can say that if that valve goes, there's a one in so many hours chance that it'll go. And we can look at this whole spaghetti junction of pipes and things, and we can say, well, if that valve sticks and that one sticks open and that one sticks closed, the whole thing's going to blow up. And we know the probability of all those things, and we can say, right, that's going to happen once in a million years, and we're going to accept this risk, or it's going to happen tomorrow, and we better do something about it. Security risk is not statistical like that. Well, at one level it is, because if you had long enough to analyse your risks, you would be able to apply statistics to them. But, well, how many times have we had a Burgess MacLean? Not very many in the last 50 years. And so we can't apply statistics too well to a lot of these risks that we're trying to manage.
Forgive me for saying so, but I'm not knocking that model, but it's not out of your head. That is a model I've seen widely disseminated. One of the biggest problems, as an information security professional in a possibly a smaller way than yourself, I've noticed that the biggest problem I face is an incredibly vague notion of the meaning of the word risk. It's bandied around right, left and centre, and nobody really seems to know in the front line what they're talking about. And that's what worries me, because unless you can establish what you mean by your terminology, you go nowhere. And what worries me is a lot of people think that a risk is essentially something bad that might happen, as opposed to a measure of something. It's like decibels in audio, which are looked on as absolutes rather than as an expression of a ratio. And what worries me is that we're using terminology that we patently don't understand, and we're using that terminology in the process of making decisions, which are going to be bad decisions because we don't understand the terms we're using. I'd like your comments on that.
Nothing very much to say on that, but in the government's sphere, we have got a risk assessment methodology, which we are supposed to follow, we are mandated to follow, called InfoSec Standard 1, and that is basically the methodology that we are supposed to use. And those terms, I think, are reasonably well defined in there. Maybe in these slides I haven't used them quite that way, for which I apologise.
You were talking earlier about hacking off the user, I think you said, is becoming harder and harder for the average punter to apply all of the security rules that are being imposed on him or her. I've got 40 passwords to remember. I'm starting to build up a collection of these little gadgets where you can generate a one-time password.
Right.
And I'm wondering how you visualise security day-to-day for the user looking, say, in 10 years' time, because this can't go on. You're talking about proliferation of data.
That's right.
But proliferation of gadgets and passwords and questions about your mother's maiden name and so on, it is also mushrooming out of control.
Yes, there are technological solutions, and in this company, a few months ago, a survey went round about the internal information systems, and one of the biggest gripes of users was the proliferation of passwords, and so we are actually rolling out internally a single sign-on solution. So there are solutions for this, and on the internet there are one or two solutions for, what you call it, federated, what's the term? Federated identity, which basically sooner or later people are going to have to get onto, and either you solve that problem or you lose your users, I'm afraid.
A couple of points on motivation, because we were talking about, you know, the personal imperative. I helped to write the very first issue of the MOD Joint Service Security Manual, cobbled together from the three single services, and we got to the point where it said, should anyone have any cause to be disaffected, he is to be marched out the room and not allowed anywhere near his terminal. This was at a time when the RAF was downsizing from 90,000 to 50,000. But then the other side of the coin was that CESG picked up on that, and in their technical document, they published a parameter which they called motivation. And if you assess the motivation was low, then you didn't need to take such draconian measures. And I pointed out that motivation can change in an instant. Yes. You cannot change the system in an instant.
No, that is very true, yes.
So, in other words, you've got to think through the worst case.
Yes.
But, I mean, you know, I've worked on systems where they've spent hundreds of thousands of pounds to prevent people breaking into the system through technical measures, when all you had to do was to slip a user 20 quid outside the gate and he'd get you the information you wanted.
Yes, it's an eternal problem and we're never going to solve it. All we can do is best practice as best we can and manage the system when it arises, I suppose.
You said earlier on about cleansing data to make sure we don't get damage. Years ago, I worked with two payroll systems, and this was still in the days of floppy disks, where you could just literally take them away and lock them in a safe.
Yes.
The first system had the most incredible passwords to get into it, but you could put any data you liked into it, whether it made sense or not. The second one, no passwords, but by golly, you couldn't put incorrect data in it, so your results were correct. I know which one I'd have bought.
Yes, when we think about security, integrity is something that we sometimes forget about. And one of the first lessons, if you go on a ISO 27001 course, is that security is confidentiality, integrity, and availability. We often don't think about availability as a risk either.
You mentioned PCI DSS earlier in your category of checklist standard. Now, my impression is that is how it is implemented largely, but need it be? If one went through PCI DSS and actually vigorously did what it proposed, would it be a better standard than it is actively now?
With PCI DSS, I'm not an expert on it. I've skimmed through it and I got the flavour of it, but I've never actually tried to implement it or anything. But yes, if like 27001, it mandated a way of implementing it so that you couldn't just say, right, we'll have a firewall there and we'll have a something or other there, it would be a lot better. And basically, if you are trained as a PCI DSS auditor, I would jolly well hope that you're trained not just to tick firewalls, but actually to look at the risk and see whether that firewall is actually in a sensible place in your network. And likewise, with all the other controls.
Sadly, it seems that your reservations are absolutely correct. Mostly it's, is this box checked? But what I'm getting at is, it seems to be the only prescriptive security standard in the public sphere as opposed to the government sphere.
Yes.
And I've always said to people that even if you don't process credit cards and don't contemplate to, it's a jolly good prescriptive standard for controls, whereas 27002 only tells you you ought to have things.
Absolutely.
And what concerns me is that we have basically a compliance culture in which the objective is to get the certificates, rather like at university, where the objective is to get the degree certificate rather than to learn the subject. And it's a cultural phenomenon rather than an IT or InfoSec phenomenon. How much do you think that impacts on the results that you see in the real world?
I think a lot, particularly in this time of cuts and downsizing and so on. Basically, the CEO basically just wants to reduce his risk by making sure that he's got the tick in the box. And it is a real problem. And as IT consultants, as information assurance consultants, is something we need to battle against continuously. Yes. Okay, well, thank you. Those have been some very interesting questions. I hope you found the talk interesting. And maybe hand over to Siva to wrap up.